Welcome to New Lens with Common Good Capital, where we talk with investors, RIAs, fund managers, and philanthropists about their experiences within different impact investing themes, as well as explore the power of stewardship and capital. I'm your host, Jeff Schaefer. As many of you know, I have a deep passion for men and women who either are incarcerated or have been. So I'm very excited today to have Ron Nickel on. He was with Prison Fellowship International for over 30 years. For those of you who don't know about the organization, hopefully you will learn a little bit today, but they clearly are the preeminent organization in this whole prison ministry space, not only here in the U.S., but outside the U.S. As CEO and president of Prison Fellowship International, Ron has extensive knowledge of the criminal justice world and has himself been to more than, this is amazing, 1,000 prisons in over 100 countries. And you and I met, I don't even remember now, 6 months ago, was it something like that? Let's just say that. But when I heard some of the stories that you were telling me, I'm like, okay, I got to get you on here to chat with our listeners. So, Ron, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, good to be with you.
So let's start off. Give us a little background of yourself, where you grew up, where you went to school, and then high level of your career.
Well, I grew up in an unlikely spot. Southwestern Alberta in Canada, a small community where I was born and raised and did my education there through secondary school. And then I decided it was time to leave home, move to Winnipeg in central Canada, where I did my undergraduate studies in psychology and English. And that's about it. You know, it was kind of an uninspiring, unillustrious beginning. Although I must say that by way of background, my childhood was quite remarkable in that my parents were extraordinary. They were a business family, and they were extraordinarily generous in the community, both with what they did financially as well as what they did in the community by investing their time and caring for people in need. So that kind of gave me an introduction to what it means to care in the community and to take responsibility for people who are in difficulty, whatever that difficulty may be.
So how did you have a career in working with men and women who are in prison? And did you do other things in your career other than that?
Well, you know, after I graduated from university, I went back to my hometown and I was expected to carry on the family business. I took over for a while, but for one reason or another, I just did not find it very compelling or challenging. So I thought, well, maybe I have to start my own business. And I did. I got a piece of property, built a small building, started a restaurant, got into the restaurant business, and it was quite successful. But having accomplished that, I felt like that was kind of a dead end for me as well. I had something in me that felt like I had to make a difference in the world, just in response to the human needs I saw around me. And I was more challenged by that than I was by business. Now, business wasn't bad. I enjoyed it, but it just something else compelled me to do something bigger.
So how old were you at that time?
Oh, I would have been 21, 22. And then I sold it and made some money.
And so then how do you make the leap into...
Well, the profit I made on the business enabled me to respond to a challenge, an opportunity in Toronto. And I'd never been further east than Winnipeg. So we moved, my wife and I moved to Toronto, where I had an opportunity to become involved with kids on the streets, kids that were trapped in addiction, kids that were homeless, kids that had just run away from home because of the difficult situations in which they were living. And a lot of kids who were on probation, I mean, they were dropouts from school, they'd gotten into trouble, they were on probation, and that became my world for a number of years, working with troubled kids.
So troubled kids.
Well, they're the next generation of offenders. And yep. Some of them, as they grew older, ended up in not only juvenile institutions, but in prison, because their crimes kept getting progressively worse or just stacked one on top of the other until they were considered incorrigible. And I followed them into the institutions. And I think that was my first introduction to the world of incarceration and what happens to people on the inside. It was kind of a life-changing experience for me. I thought I would do it only for a couple of years, maybe. But I became hooked working with these young offenders and their families, because some of them, I would say maybe half of them, had parents with a background in prison.
So then when did you actually make an official leap with an organization? Was the only organization you're with Prison Fellowship International?
No, when I was in Toronto, I was working with an organization that is now called Youth Unlimited. They had affiliates around the world. So after having achieved a measure of success in Toronto, doing innovative things with kids on the streets, things like taking them on wilderness experiences, taking them out of the city into the wilderness, putting them into a different environment where they were challenged, had to learn to work together, cooperate. There was an interest in some of the other countries for me to show them what could be done or to help them figure out what could be done in their context. And so I was invited to do quite a bit of work in the U.S., across Canada. And then I had an opportunity to go to Chile. And this was during the time of the Pinochet regime. It was one of those life-changing experiences, going into Chile, visiting a juvenile institution, walking the streets, going into a prison. And I just could not believe the misery that I encountered. It changed my life. And from that point on, I pretty much knew that this would define my life.
So I have a feeling we're going to totally digress from any questions that I had originally thought I was going to ask you. So hang with me on this journey.
Actually. Of course, I'm going off on a tangent here too.
No. So let me step back. For those who have not cursory are aware and know of the criminal justice system and inmates and that whole world, from somebody who's been involved with this for 30 years, what would you say to a group of people who just go, what have you learned? And are there things that we should be doing as individuals and as society as it relates to this whole problem? I know it's a big question.
Oh, man, I could spend days responding to that question. But basically, it comes down to treating all people with respect and compassion. The folks who end up in prison didn't get there by accident. Something happened to them often early on in their experience to kind of bend them in a certain direction. And the worst thing that we can do, I think, is to segregate people like that from normal society. See, what happens when you take someone and put them in prison is you're putting them in an environment that is completely populated by like-minded people, people with similar experience.
Yep.
And they don't get better. It doesn't matter what you do. Because in an institution, it becomes an us against them kind of thing. The authorities, the structure versus the inmate. Inmate versus the structure. And they don't get better. Some of them, yes, they manage to find a way forward. It's usually through some outside influence, or for some of them, it's a wake-up call. But roughly 75% to 80% of the people who are in prison today have been there before or will re-offend after they're released. So it doesn't work. We have to find a better way. One of the big problems is what happens to them after their sentence, their initial sentence or subsequent sentence. It's very, very difficult for them to reintegrate into society. Think about friendships, family, jobs, where they live. All of those things are stacked up against them. And it takes an extraordinary person to make it after prison. We've developed a game called One Life, where we take business people into prison.
Yep.
And they play this game with inmates. It's a board game, but it's a challenging exercise in finding your way forward after prison, all of the things that you have to do. I can't go into the detail here, but it has a profound impact on the participants. So we get these business guys and women coming into prison, sitting down with the inmates, and it's always the inmates who win the game because the business folks have no idea what's involved in making it on the outside when you're coming out of prison. And it helps them understand the situation, and some of them become responsive and open themselves up to hiring ex-offenders just because they now understand what the difficulty is.
Yeah, so I was in I think we talked about 6 months ago, I started to go into prisons when I was a freshman at Wheaton College. So that was 30 years ago, roughly, and have been involved in different fashions over the last 30 years. But I was in a prison in California probably 6 years ago, working with these guys who I think to be in this program, they were probably a year to 2 years from getting released. And so we would help them put together resumes and we'd role play doing a job interview. And it's not funny. It's not funny, but I will tell you, and it's ironic what you just said, the creativity that these guys had in writing their resume. And I don't mean they were lying about it, but you know, the jobs that they'd have and the titles that they'd have in prison was very creative. But you just realize that the deck is so stacked against them. And to your point, I can imagine if we were in prison and get out, it would be a sad state of us trying to succeed because there's just so many things that are stacked.
Well, you come out with nothing.
Yeah. And we could go down that whole path. There's a huge exposure people need to realize from, you know, getting let out at 2 a.m. and with $20, no license, and saying, you got to get 6 hours away from here and go see your parole officer. Well, okay, how's that going to happen? So, we could go down that path. Let me digress a little bit and then we'll come back. So you're retired today. Is that correct?
Well, I don't think there's such a thing as retired. Yeah, I'm not working in the job that I once had.
Okay, so then let me ask this question. How would you best describe yourself at your age and what you're doing in the context of where you're at in your life journey?
I guess I'm a pilgrim. I'm continuing this pilgrimage of trying to make a difference wherever I am. In my community, I'm now in a different kind of community. It's a fishing community. And as you might expect, fishermen can be kind of a rough and tumble lot of folks. When we moved here, I decided the best thing I could do was to become a fisherman. So I worked for a few years, just seasonally, with one of the fishermen. And that kind of gave me my, not street credibility, but sea credibility to develop relationships with them and to have an opportunity to relate to them about issues that they were going through that they would have never told me about, apart from that trust that built as I became part of their community. I've done a lot of writing. I've just published a book called Hope in the Ruins, based on my experiences around the world in prisons with people and prison situations, and how hope that seems to be almost extinguished can grow in the most unlikely circumstances with a little help. So I'm doing some writing, trying to influence people. I'm still involved with Prison Fellowship as a leadership coach and consultant when various issues come up. We now have affiliated organizations in 125 countries. So there's a lot of opportunity to continue an involvement with people who are on the front lines. And that's my passion.
Okay, so I've got two questions and I'm going to say them both because I'm going to forget them. And these are two totally different directions. One question is how do you deal with, and this may come out wrong, but how do you deal with, as it relates to all of us, but specifically in the criminal justice system, personal responsibility versus the environment, the system? That's kind of one I'd love to discuss. And then a second thing would be, give us a story, if you can, of hope that could inspire us.
Well, the first question of personal responsibility versus environment and all of the factors that influence a person, it's also a deeper question than that, because we don't all have the same wherewithal to make good decisions and to make good choices when we're in an environment of difficulty. There was a study done quite a number of years ago by a criminal psychiatrist and a group of criminal psychiatrists in New York trying to determine the cause of crime. Was it environment or opportunity? What was it? They came to the conclusion that there were no external factors that predisposed a person toward criminality, but that it was their internal moral disposition that had a lot to do with early childhood education. So the moral formation of the child, particularly between the ages of 0 and 4, but also thereafter in terms of that early childhood education that gave them the emotional and mental wherewithal to make good decisions, irrespective of the circumstances. So that's one way of looking at it. Not to say that circumstances don't have a huge influence, because some people will do something if an opportunity presents itself and they think there's nobody watching or they won't get caught.
Well, I ask that question because you tend to find people fall on one side or the other. And look, I'm not an expert in this, but from my experience, it's a delicate balance of both.
Yeah, it's not either or at all. Right. It's both and.
Yeah. So then I don't know if you have a story from the book or if you just have a story. I mean, I don't know if this is a story you're going to tell, but I remember when I asked you 6 months ago, whatever it is, have you seen a prison system that worked? You shared one with me. And I don't know if that's worthy, but that was pretty inspiring to hear.
Well, it is actually, because my whole orientation has been kind of, I'm not a prison abolitionist by any means, but I know that prisons don't work. Just the failure rate is phenomenal. Until I went to a prison in Brazil called APAC, the Association for the Protection and Assistance of the Condemned or the Convicted. Remarkable story how it started. It was essentially begun by a psychologist, a lawyer, and a judge who felt that they could do something in prison that would make a difference. And so they were able, with government support, to start a small prison with a group of inmates that they had been meeting with weekly to talk about their lives and so forth. They separated them out from the other institutions, created an environment of respect, of responsibility for one another, and where there were no guards on the inside or on the outside. They actually gave the keys to the prison to the most trusted inmates.
Yeah, you're already talking counterintuitive right here.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The whole culture of the institution is based on respect and responsibility and mutual accountability. And the results are surprising. About 95% success rate. 5% or less of the inmates who go through that institution or institutions like that end up reoffending. There are now more than 90 such institutions in Brazil, catering for all categories of inmates, those who have life sentence, those who have committed serious offenses, repeat offenses. They're required to apply to go to that institution, to a PAC. And some of them, when they apply, they think, well, that's going to be an easy thing to do. You know, we'll probably have opportunities to escape. We'll probably be able to manipulate that system, whatever. But when they enter in, they discover an environment that is so different from prison that they don't know what to do with it, what to make of it. It's a long story, but I see guys coming out of there. I remember one inmate I met who had been responsible for several homicides. And he said, you know, I can't give people back their lives. I took their lives. I can't make amends for that, but I can do something. And he heard about a man who needed a kidney. So he donated his kidney to save another man's life. And it's stories like that, people who say, I can't fix what I've done in the past, but I can do something now.
Can you share some examples of how that prison looks different than what you and I would go into here in the U.S. or experientially?
Well, everybody has to work. They're required to participate in cleaning. They all have a job. They're places of production, and it's not forced labor. But before you go in, you know that you're going to have to do something to be productive. So that's the first thing I noticed. Most of our prisons, almost all of our prisons, are not places of productivity. They're unproductive. People are literally doing time, wasting time. And so they go into the APAC system, they work, and isn't necessarily always work that is like making bricks or producing something. Sometimes it's just creative work, but they are required to do something, to invest themselves in some kind of productive activity. The cells have no locks. The person who welcomes you when you go to the door of the prison, the person who welcomes you and unlocks the door is an inmate. So you don't have any of the conflict between the establishment, the authoritarian system, and the residents. It is the residents themselves taking responsibility for the institution under the guidance of volunteers from the community who provide a kind of oversight, but they're not on the inside a lot of the time.
What do they do if a new inmate or an inmate, whatever, acts out? What happens in that environment?
Well, there's an inmate disciplinary committee comprised of inmates, and they decide what's warranted, whether it means the person is expelled from that institution and has to go back to the normal system, or whether there is something that person should be required to do. It's all focused on mediation. How do you mediate whatever conflict there is, whether it's conflict between individuals or a conflict with the expectations of the institution? How is that resolved? Now, that inmate disciplinary committee is comprised of inmates, but again, with outside advisors, just to kind of moderate anything that might turn into a difficult direction.
Well, you know, obviously your experience is multiples of my experience, but I have been in multiple states and multiple prisons, and it doesn't take a rocket scientist to quickly walk into these institutions. And I'm assuming what we see here in the U.S. is the night and day difference than what we see outside the U.S. But you treat these men and women like animals, they're going to act like animals. I mean, you see it. And I think what most people don't realize is that if they too were thrown in that environment, they would probably act in ways, or could act in ways, that they would never have dreamed of.
Yeah. You know, it's not that we treat them like animals. It's just that we treat them like they don't matter, like they're worthless.
Yep.
And then when they come out, they discover that there is no place for them. They are worthless. They don't matter until they do something.
All right. So I'm going to switch a few more questions. I'm going to switch to, you know, the podcast. One of the things we talk about is we're talking about stewardship. We're talking about capital. And so I'm going to ask you this, and we'll see I'm curious how you go on this. When did you realize the power of capital? Whether that ties into the criminal justice system or not, I'd just be curious how you'd answer that question.
Well, I don't think I recall exactly when I learned the power of capital. I grew up where I saw the power of capital and what my parents were doing with their resources, with their businesses, in helping people who were in trouble. It was interesting. I was invited to my hometown 3 years ago to give the keynote address at the 100th anniversary celebration of my hometown. And after I spoke, I met a lot of the people, and it was surprising to me the number of folks who came up and said, you know, when I couldn't afford groceries, or when we moved here from another place and were poor, we needed groceries, but we didn't have money, and we went to your father's supermarket and he extended credit. When we couldn't pay it, he would just say, don't worry about it. The time will come when you can. So I saw the power of generosity, not just generous expenditure of capital, but a generosity of spirit and how people were treated with dignity. That to me is all part of stewardship. It's not just what we do with our capital. It's the generosity that comes out of how we live our lives in response to people. I think the easy thing is to give money. The more difficult thing is to be generous in your attitude and in your responses to a person in difficulty, or even a difficult person, because some people are difficult.
Yeah, and not to single out those men and women who have been in prison, but there's no question giving capital in some form or fashion to that segment is easier than rolling up your sleeves and coming alongside of them. And the reality is they, like all of us, is not just about capital. I mean, it could be money. I shouldn't say it's not just about money. It could be about capital. It could be about relational capital. It could be about knowledge, all that kind of stuff. So then let me circle that question and say, from what you've seen within, say, men and women who are getting out of prison, what is their plight as it relates to capital?
Well, we have found, and we've done quite a bit of work in this, we gave them capital through micro lending, for example, so that they could start a small business. And some of these people are quite creative when it comes to business and have quite the motivation to do something to provide for their families or to provide for others. We had one fellow who we gave some funding to, a loan, by way of a loan. There's no such a thing as a free gift, because that is often counterproductive. You want to teach responsibility. So
what's interesting, you want to teach responsibility, but the other side that most people don't think about, they also want to be treated like a normal human being.
Ah, yes.
Sorry to take you from a train of thought, but I had to throw that in.
One fellow started a small carpet weaving business in Nepal, and he would only hire other ex-offenders. The only people he would, he says, that was the only people I can trust. But I know what he was saying. He says they're in the same shoes that I was, and I have no choice but to help them.
Yep.
So yeah, you can't get ahead without resources and resourcing. How it is that we resource someone, whether it's through a loan or whether it's through giving them a job or through coaching, you know, helping them figure out the steps they need to take in order to make a way forward in getting a job, mentoring, coaching. I know one fellow in Detroit who probably coached a dozen or more ex-offenders through the years in learning how to work and learning how to keep a job, because that's often just as difficult as getting a job. It's giving them the wherewithal. And part of that is money by way of a loan or something, but a lot of it is the goodwill of investing time and effort with these people.
Well, I don't know, Ron, if I shared with you about this, but we are walking in faith. My wife and I have made currently three investments into businesses in this case. Well, two of them are run by formerly incarcerated men. And one of them is not run by formerly incarcerated, but hires formerly incarcerated. That's not to say the other two that are run by, they also hire formerly incarcerated. But we feel called in the second half of our life, however long that lasts, that this is a place we've been called, which is to invest in these types of businesses from a capital perspective, but then also what you just said is trying to put people around them, not only for moral support, but business acumen, relational equity. So we are walking step by step in this, but I'd be curious, am I crazy for trying to go down this path?
No, I think that's spot on, because resources alone won't get a person back on their feet.
Yep.
They need to walk with somebody. They need a buddy, a mentor, a coach, you know, whatever we want to call it. They need someone to help them utilize the funding and to make the right decisions and to do the right things in managing the funding and in building a business or whatever it is.
Well, I'm going to come back to you at some point on this to have you be an advisor to help me think about, well, A, to connect me with potential avenues of pipeline, if that's I hate to say it that way, but a pipeline of men and women and businesses that we should be looking at. It's going to take a handful of us, not just myself, is the big issue, but a big opportunity. And I'll just close this out and then I'll ask you one last question. As I'm in the financial services industry, and so as I've made some of these investments, I literally have had these incongruent moments in my head where I'm doing due diligence on these businesses. Because in my normal world, if you had a criminal background, the first thing you do, you rip it up. And so here I am asking these questions and I find myself, it's like, wait, do you actually, I don't even know how to say this, but you know, do you have enough formerly incarcerated in your business? Is it enough for us? And I'll be having these questions. And there's been one time where I'm like, I'm so sorry, but I am just having this crazy thoughts because I'm nuts for wanting to do this. But I will say this, part of the bet for me is, and by the way, it's a calling, but I've seen it. These men and women, when they have been broken, and this is true of all of us, and they are empowered to move forward, their level of desire and commitment to succeed is palpable. Not only for themselves, for their family, for their community. And those are entrepreneurs or those are business owners that, whether they have a criminal background or not, those are people I want to invest in.
Yeah. And it'll make a difference for generations because the impact is not just on them, but in their families.
Yep.
And as you say, in the community, it does make a longitudinal difference beyond the individual.
Yeah. Okay. Last question. This is a big question. So if it's hard to answer, it doesn't have to be the number one thing. But if you could have a dream come true in your life, what would that be?
Oh, well, I think it's just the multiplication of people like you who care about this issue or issues like this and want to make a difference by investing themselves and their resources in changing the way things are.
Do Do you leave your 30 years in prison work discouraged, encouraged, or wherever else you could put it?
Did I leave encouraged or discouraged?
Yeah.
I think a bit of both, because I put everything I had. I mean, I traveled globally for 50% of the time for more than 30 years, kind of pushing and prodding against the system on issues of justice, pushing and prodding with communities and people to say, you've got to get involved. You can make a difference. And whether those were churches or community organizations, I tried to motivate people to make a difference. And yes, a lot of good things did happen, but not to the degree that I had hoped or expected. So it's both. You know, I'm gratified by what did happen, very dissatisfied that more did not happen. And in some cases now I look at the situation in the world and we're taking steps backward. You think about if you and I can't show civility and respect to one another, how are we ever going to show civility and respect to people who are in prison or coming out of prison? I see civility and respect going down the tubes in society. That's an ill omen.
Yeah, there isn't even an ability to really disagree or even get into discussions to hammer through a lot of difficult issues in the world today. You know, you cut them off or you don't agree. And I see it all over the place, and so do you. But I see it even in the investing world, where around this impact investing, where people align their values with what they care about. And yet you can see people get in the far opposite end of the corners and be like, well, I'm not going to join you because all I care about is this or this. And
yeah,
there is typically common ground, even though if their why may be different, but a lot of common ground that should be and can be built on.
Yes.
Well, look, I want to appreciate you for your insight and knowledge and your willingness to come on and share. I appreciate your vulnerability. As a guy who has a deep passion for formerly incarcerated, I'm envious of your career, although I can only imagine the wear and tear on your body going across the globe for that. But I just want to say, not that it matters, but thank you for your care and concern for men and women all across the globe. And I am, as you mentioned, I'm sure it didn't impact the level that you would have loved to have seen, but I've had enough interactions with these men and women. And if it was only one, yeah, it was worth it. That probably goes against the capitalistic mindset. Or it's capitalistic, but I'm sure there are amazing stories about what you've done. So anyways, with that, don't forget to subscribe to A New Lens with Common Good Capital on your podcast app of choice. And please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. This will help new listeners find the show and hopefully put them on a path to a more fulfilling portfolio within the impact investing space. I'm Jeff Schaefer. Ron, anything you want to say in closing?
No, thank you. It's been good chatting with you. Could have gone longer, I'm sure, but I appreciate your interest in this difficult area.
Just remind us the name of your book.
Hope in the Ruins.
Okay, and I'm assuming we can get it.
Amazon, Barnes & Noble, whatever.
All right, we will do that. Well, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This podcast is a production of Common Good Capital and does not constitute an offer or a solicitation of an offer. Such offer would only be made through a private placement memorandum. Prospective investors in private placement securities should be aware that making an investment is speculative and involves a high degree of risk, including the risk of losing all or a portion of an investment. Investments of this nature are illiquid and subject to substantial restrictions upon transferability.